Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 362, titled Networking. Enron, Saudi Arabia, and September 11th. This is being recorded on June 10th of the year 2002, and again, I want to emphatically encourage listeners to tape this program and to use the web in order to distribute this information. As time will permit, I will give the address, the URL, etc., for Spitfire, which has all of these programs on record, and I will also be giving the URL for sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. A tip of the hat on tonight's program to a member of the listening audience who basically turned me on to this information, and in particular, a big tip of the hat to John Loftus. For those of you who are not familiar with John Loftus is the author of a number of books. He authored The Belarus Secret. He co-authored with Mark Aron's Unholy Trinity and also the book The Secret War Against the Jews that I've used many times on this broadcast. John Loftus is a former career military officer and Justice Department investigator with a very high security clearance. He was investigating Nazi war criminals who were brought into the United States by the intelligence community. He participated in an award-winning 60 Minutes broadcast about that subject. He then left the Justice Department and has been acting for many years as an unpaid attorney for whistleblowers within the U.S. intelligence community and other intelligence communities. In particular, he had power of attorney for some 100-plus veteran U.S., British, Soviet, and Israeli intelligence operatives who, on conditions of anonymity, received approval through John Loftus, who had power of attorney, for these intelligence operatives to publish their information, and that information was published in the book The Secret War Against the Jews that I've used many times on this program. This particular broadcast deals with one of the many elements of cover-up in connection with September 11th, and I want to stress, as I have pointed out many times, I think this is a much more complex event than it has generally been made out to be. And I also want to emphasize that, in my opinion, it is some of the economic relationships and some of the professional inertia or resume inertia that is connected with these events that permitted the attacks of September 11th to go forward. I want to note that because oftentimes I think under the rubric of, quote, conspiracy theory, unquote, many of these relationships are oversimplified and people tend to view take a one-dimensional view of what has taken place. It is my considered opinion still that the Underground Reich, as I have called it, was behind these attacks and that it utilized infiltration of the U.S. intelligence system, economic system, and political system to effect these attacks, and utilizing the largely Muslim population of what has been called the Earth Island, or what the Nazis called the Earth Island. That is a giant landmass stretching from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way through Europe, the former Soviet Union, most of the Middle East, and China, India, Pakistan, and it is a giant landmass embracing most of the world's petroleum reserves, and across the middle of that is a huge Muslim population. The Nazis viewed control of that Muslim population as the key to controlling what they called the Earth Island. That is most of the world's landmass and most of the world's petroleum reserves, and that brings us up to the present. The following articles, the articles that will comprise the bulk of this broadcast, are posted on John Loftus's website. That can be found at www.johnloftus.com/enron1.htm/no, K-N-O-W. Once again, www.johnloftus, J-O-H-N hyphen L-O-F-T-U-S dot com, /Enron1.htm/, you know, the pound sign or number sign, K-N-O-W. This first article is titled, What Congress Does Not Know About September 11th. This is dated May 31st of 2002 for immediate release. The author's background is described again. As a former federal prosecutor, John Loftus had insider's knowledge of high-level intelligence operations, including obstruction of congressional investigations. Loftus resigned from the Justice Department in 1981 to expose how the intelligence community had recruited Nazi war criminals and then concealed the files from congressional subpoena. After appearing on an Emmy Award-winning segment of 60 Minutes, Loftus has spent the next two decades writing histories of intelligence cover-ups and serving as an unpaid lawyer helping other whistleblowers inside U.S. intelligence. Now, what John Loftus alleges in this pair of articles that I'm going to be reading is, first of all, that Enron was acting as a broker, basically, a negotiating entity for U.S. energy companies, including Unocal, in which the elder George Bush has considerable stock, and that in turn Enron had been negotiating with the Taliban and working through the Saudis in order to effect a pipeline through Afghanistan in order to basically access the Caspian Basin petroleum and fossil fuels reserves, roughly one-eighth of the estimated by many to be one-eighth of the petroleum reserves on the face of the earth. It, in turn, is alleged in this article that because of the Enron cover-up, because of the Enron role in negotiating with the Taliban, discussion of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda was basically suppressed, and analysis of them, or at least release of this information to the public, was suppressed, and that basically FBI/CIA investigation of this was basically put on hold, and that it was the knowledge of this, which of the Taliban/Enron negotiations, which were known apparently to Al-Qaeda from roughly 1998 on, or the fact that this was known to FBI and CIA, and it is alleged in this pair of articles that this permitted the September 11th attacks to go forward, not only because of the suppression of FBI and CIA investigation of Al-Qaeda due to the Enron negotiations with the Taliban, but also because of the fact that this was apparently known to Al-Qaeda, and the fact that there was silence about this must have clued, it is speculated by John Loftus here, that this must have clued Al-Qaeda into the fact that basically the fix was in. It is also alleged here that one of the aspects of this deal was to give the very powerful Saudi Bin Laden group and the Bin Laden Construction Company, which is the main element of that, a large share of the construction of the Caspian Basin pipeline. Again, this article is titled What Congress Does Not Know About Enron and September 11th. It reads as follows, and this is authored by John Loftus. A captured Al-Qaeda document reveals that U.S. energy companies were secretly negotiating with the Taliban to build a pipeline. The document was obtained by the FBI, but was not allowed to be shared with other agencies in order to protect Enron. Multiple sources confirm that American law enforcement agencies were deliberately kept in the dark and systematically prevented from connecting the dots before 9-1-1 in order to aid Enron's secret and immoral Taliban negotiations. The suppressed Al-Qaeda document tends to support recent claims of a cover-up made by several mid-level intelligence and law enforcement figures. Their ongoing terrorist investigations appear to have been hindered during the same sensitive time period while the Enron Corporation was still negotiating with the Taliban. An inadvertent result of the Taliban pipeline cover-up was that the Taliban's friends in Al-Qaeda were able to complete their last 8 months of preparations for 9-1-1 while the Enron secrecy block was still in force. Next, John Loftus discusses three different blocks of passing of information to the intelligence community, the first of these in connection with the disclosures to Congress of blatant violations of civil rights during the anti-Vietnam War period. The first block came in the 1970s as a result of congressional reaction to domestic espionage against the anti-Vietnam War movement. In a case of blatant overreaction, the FBI placed all houses of worship and religious charities off limits for any surveillance whatsoever unless there was independent probable cause. This meant that all mosques and other Muslim meeting places for terrorist groups were effectively off limits until after a crime had been committed. The block order was not lifted until last week by Attorney General Ashcroft. And the next block order concerns the block against investigating the Saudi royal family and Saudi Arabia in connection with terrorism. This not only to help conceal Saudi support for the insurgency against the Soviets in Afghanistan, the first Afghan war, but also to conceal something that I had speculated about at considerable length in the fall of 1999, namely the petroleum faction of U.S. intelligence and Wahhabi/Saudi support for the insurgency in Chechnya, aimed at basically securing that area for the petroleum companies in order to basically ensure their access to the Caspian Sea basin. The second block order, in force since the 1980s, was against any investigation that would embarrass the Saudi royal family. Originally, it was designed to conceal Saudi support for Muslim extremists fighting against the Soviets in Afghanistan and later Chechnya, but it went too far. Oliver North noted in his autobiography that every time he tried to do something about terrorism links in the Middle East, he was told to stop because it might embarrass the Saudis. This block remains in place. As the combined result of these two blocks, the Saudis were able to fund Middle Eastern terrorists in complete secrecy during the 1990s through a network of Muslim charities in Virginia, Tampa, and Florida. The Saudi funding network was targeted at the destruction of the State of Israel and the obstruction of the Palestinian peace process. The Saudi funding conduit has now been exposed and shut down by means of a private lawsuit, Loftus versus Sami al-Aryan, which is currently pending in Hillsborough County, Florida. The lawsuit, filed on March 20, 2002, influenced the government into raiding the Saudi charities in Herndon, Virginia, a few hours later. By the way, I discussed this at considerable length in For the Record 356 and For the Record 357, and I noted in that broadcast that there are very profound evidentiary tributaries running to the highest levels of the Republican Party, and that in turn some of these funding conduits have an interlocking directorate with NADA Management, or Al-Taqwa as it was called, an organization dating all the way back to the pre-World War II and World War II periods of the Third Reich. Not an organization per se, but an organization members of which have a political heritage dating back all the way to the pre-World War II and World War II period. It was alleged in a March 12, 2002 San Francisco Chronicle article that François Genoux had founded Al-Taqwa. Turning once again to this Loftus article, after filing the Al-Aryan lawsuit, Attorney Loftus began to receive very detailed documents and information about a third block, a prohibition on investigations concerning the Taliban. In the early 1990s, a consortium of American oil companies led by Unocal had hired Enron to determine the profitability of building an oil and gas pipeline across Afghanistan so that America could have access to the Caspian Sea basin, holding one-eighth of the world's energy supplies. There is no doubt that these secret negotiations existed and that they were known to Al-Qaeda. Loftus recently received an FBI translation of a highly classified and encrypted Al-Qaeda document circa 1997-1998, which was retrieved and decrypted from a computer laptop following the embassy bombing in Africa. The document was written by Osama bin Laden's military commander, Mohammed Atef, under his nom de guerre, Abu Haf, and reveals extensive knowledge of the supposedly secret pipeline negotiations and their potential economic worth to the Taliban, Pakistan, and the U.S. Former Afghanistan CIA agent Robert Baer has recently published a book charging that the cover-up of the 1990s pipeline negotiations revealed extensive financial corruption inside the Clinton administration and contributed to the lack of intelligence before 9/11. The Taliban negotiations temporarily collapsed in 1999 after Clinton reversed his NSC advisor's policy and ordered a missile strike against terrorists in Afghanistan. However, in January 2001, Vice President Cheney allegedly reinstated the intelligence block and expanded it to effectively preclude any investigations whatsoever of Saudi, Taliban, Afghan oil connections. Former FBI counterterrorism chief John O'Neill resigned from the FBI in disgust, stating that he was ordered not to investigate Saudi al-Qaeda connections because of the Enron pipeline deal. Loftus has confirmed that it was O'Neill who originally discovered the al-Qaeda pipeline memo after the embassy bombings in Africa. O'Neill gave an overview of the Enron block to two French authors who will soon be publishing in the United States. The FBI is currently investigating Loftus's links to John O'Neill and is also refusing FBI agent Robert Wright permission to publish his own findings about the Enron block. Loftus asserts that the Enron block, which remained in force from January 2001 until August 2001 when the pipeline deal collapsed, is the reason that none of FBI agent Rowley's requests for investigations were ever approved. As numerous British and French authors have concluded, the information provided by European intelligence sources prior to 9/11 was so extensive that it is no longer possible for either CIA or the FBI to assert a defense of incompetence. It is time for Congress to face the truth. In order to give Enron one last, desperate chance to complete the Taliban pipeline and save itself from bankruptcy, senior levels of U.S. intelligence were ordered to keep their eyes shut and their subordinates ignorant. The Enron cover-up confirms that September 11th was not an intelligence failure or a law enforcement The Enron cover-up confirms that September 11th was not an intelligence failure or a law enforcement failure, at least not entirely. Instead, it was a foreign policy failure of the highest order. If Congress ever combines its Enron investigation with September 11th, Cheney's whole house of cards will collapse. And this next article is entitled, The Enron Pipeline Connection to September 11th. This was prefaced by, this is a privileged and confidential work document restricted to his legal researchers. However, it has been posted on John Loftus's website, so I'm going to assume, since that basically constitutes, from a legal standpoint, publication, that this is okay to disseminate. Indeed, I think that given the intense importance of the events, I think it is essential that this information get out. As I said, this is posted on John Loftus's website at www.johnloftus.com/enron1.htm/no. Again, the Enron pipeline connection to September 11th. A highly reliable confidential client source who wishes to remain anonymous has promised to send me an FBI copy of a high-level al-Qaeda report dating back to the embassy bombings in Africa several years ago. The email report was captured in Africa from the computer file of a senior aide to Osama bin Laden. My client has obtained this document through lawful means. The email report, written by al-Qaeda's head of military operations, Mohammed Atef, describes al-Qaeda's view of ongoing secret pipeline negotiations between the U.S. oil companies and the Taliban to build a pipeline through Afghanistan. This Atef report was almost certainly reviewed by the late John O'Neill at the time of the embassy bombing, shortly after the al-Qaeda report was written. At the time, O'Neill was the FBI agent in charge of the embassy bombing investigation. The shocking pipeline information may explain why O'Neill became fixated about the Saudi-Taliban-Al-Qaeda relationship for the few remaining years of his life. After O'Neill's investigations were repeatedly shut down by his superiors, O'Neill allegedly began making discreet inquiries to French intelligence using two reporters as cutouts. Both reporters were known consultants for French intelligence and are specialists on both the oil industry and terrorism. It is plausible that the French government was upset at being shut out of the Caspian Basin deal and may have been helping O'Neill behind the backs of his superiors in Washington. It does seem that the more O'Neill learned, the less he was allowed to do with it. The last straw was Cheney's refusal to follow up on O'Neill's request to pursue the leads in the Phoenix memo in April of 2001. After resigning from the FBI in disgust, John O'Neill spoke candidly to several people, including the two French authors whom he met again in July. They have now written about the pipeline deal in The Forbidden Truth. The book, not yet translated into English, quotes O'Neill as saying that his Al-Qaeda investigations were blocked to protect the Saudis. The Caspian Basin pipeline issue is discussed at length as the motive for the cover-up. I do not think that the French authors have the ATEF document, or they would have released it in their book. The ATEF memo may indeed be a smoking gun, but I need to see the exact text to be sure before I release it to Congress. This Al-Qaeda document may be the first hard evidence to break the Enron pipeline cover-up apart. I need your advice and confidential assistance in making a discreet collection of all Afghan pipeline research for a memo to present to Congress. Here is my investigative hypothesis, which needs to be greatly fleshed out and footnoted before I go to Congress. I have presented my thoughts by topic rather than in chronological order. Back in the 1970s and 80s, Saudi intelligence, not the CIA as has been reported, funded the early Taliban faction and later Al-Qaeda as part of the insurgency to throw the Russians out of Afghanistan. A few years afterwards, U.S. energy companies, Enron as the Afghan pipeline consultant for UNICAL, used the Saudi intelligence connection to the Taliban to begin negotiations for a pipeline across Afghanistan. Prince Turki, chief of Saudi intelligence, has publicly admitted making several trips into Afghanistan to negotiate a peace mission with the Taliban. My sources say he was the pipeline mediator for Enron. Prince Turki was fired as head of Saudi intelligence immediately after the pipeline discussions collapsed in August of 2001. By the way, in that very same month, the Saudis canceled scheduled annual military maneuvers with the United States just hours before they were scheduled to begin without explanation. Continuing. Prince Turki is allegedly close to the bin Laden family, which was allegedly promised the construction contract in return for a percentage to the Saudi royal family. Beginning again, Prince Turki is allegedly close to the bin Laden family, which was allegedly promised a construction contract in return for a percentage to the Saudi royal family. This is a common business practice initiated by the Carlyle Group's contracts in Saudi Arabia. As the Republican IPO magazine Red Herring confirms, President Bush's father was business partners in the Carlyle Group with the bin Laden family during the same period. This company is a who's who of former Democratic and Republican intelligence and political officials whose specialty is acting as super lobbyists at the highest levels of government. They are also suspected of arranging construction kickbacks to the Saudi royal family in return for discount oil sales. Red Herring alleges that during a visit to Kennebunkport, Bush Sr. lectured his son on placating the Saudis, especially with regard to Israel, and even called the Saudis on in his son's presence to reassure them that he had told his son their point of view. Apparently, the deeply angered President Bush mentioned the private meeting with his father to a close friend who leaked it to Red Herring. Shortly afterward, another Republican newspaper, the Boston Herald, ran a scathing exposé on the number of White House officials with investments in Saudi oil, calling it, unquote, obscene conflict of interest, unquote. It should be noted that President Bush at first seemed to reject his father's advice about Israel quite strongly and secretly ordered all American troops to begin a total withdrawal from Saudi Arabia. White House sources began a steady drumbeat of leaks about Saudi involvement with terrorism and even authorized long-delayed raids on the Saudi charities in Virginia that served as a money laundry for terrorist operations against Israel. Suddenly, President Bush made a sudden and startling switch to adopt a more pro-Saudi view. The documents seized in the Virginia raids are barely being translated, let alone investigated. Nevertheless, the Israelis have been privately informed that criminal cases against the Saudi-financed terrorists in the U.S., like Sami al-Arian, are being dropped for, quote, lack of evidence, unquote, before the evidence has even been collated. The State Department's recent report on global terrorism is being denounced as a blatant whitewash by Republicans and Democrats alike. A plausible explanation for the dramatic policy reversal is that someone, allegedly Cheney, told President Bush to call off the dogs at CIA and FBI because if the Saudis went down, they would take his father down with them. I think our president has a good heart, but is completely boxed in and does not know how to get out from under his father's legacy. The Israeli government is angered and bewildered over the sudden switch and has begun to release documents showing prior U.S. knowledge of al-Qaeda operations as well as Saudi support for terrorism. As Crown Prince Abdullah's visit to both Bushes in Texas showed, a modus vivendi has been reached. The simplest explanation is that both Crown Prince Abdullah and President Bush can blackmail each other over the Taliban pipeline. Both sides have agreed to pretend that they have always been allies in the war against terrorism and that Iraq is the real enemy. Mutual blackmail makes a bit of sense. The Saudi intelligence connection was the key to get the Taliban pipeline negotiations going without the CIA or FBI finding out. The Enron political connection to the Bush and Clinton administrations was key to keeping the CIA and FBI off of the Saudis' backs while the negotiations were underway. Messy little details about terrorism are swept under the rug for the sake of the big picture. The truth is already starting to leak out. It has just been discovered that Enron had purchased huge tracts of land in the Caspian Basin, especially in Turkmenistan, which property is allegedly still on their books. The acreage is enormous and worthless. But if the Taliban pipeline had been built, Enron might have owned some of the most valuable oil exploration sites in the world and rescued itself from insolvency. Any White House insider who helped Enron would have gotten rich, filthy rich. When Bush's son came into office, Enron allegedly approached Cheney in late January and told him vaguely about the secret Saudi-Taliban pipeline negotiations and how important it was to America's energy policy for generations to come. Like an idiot, Cheney agreed to keep the lid on any Saudi-Taliban investigations for a while. For the sake of the Caspian Basin pipeline, Cheney passed the word inside the Beltway not to allow anyone in the government to connect the dots. All across America, ongoing Saudi-Taliban investigations were hindered, obstructed, or closed down, just as the Clinton administration had done before them. What no one did was check Enron's accounting. The pipeline deal made little economic sense in view of Russian cooperation. To Enron's horror, the pipeline deal collapsed in August. Then came 9/11. Then came the Enron collapse. Then came the Cheney cover-up. Cheney's biggest problem is the two fairly senior intelligence officials who rebelled and became whistleblowers, Robert Bayer of CIA and John O'Neill of FBI. The rest of the FBI and CIA higher-ups have kept their mouths shut, although a lot of lower-level people are now coming forward to question their superiors' strange behavior. The two rebels, Bayer of CIA and O'Neill of FBI, were, of course, driven into retirement. We're going to continue with this discussion in the second half of this program. Various tapes that I've done over the years are available from Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Their email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. You can visit the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. The two most recent pair of half-hour segments is available for roughly a week on the Spitfire website, again, equipped with Real Audio. And there are long written and very detailed annotated descriptions of the various programs, the For the Record programs, in particular, the programs about September 11th, 325 and ongoing, are considerably detailed and very lengthy indeed. Those are in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. There are also links to two URLs being maintained by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey, WFMU.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y, and a longer URL containing older For the Record programs available for download only. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 362, Networking, Enron, Saudi Arabia, and September 11th. This is being recorded on June 10th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.